Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Lawmakers return to Montpelier this week for a veto session to deal with teachers' health care and the legalization of marijuana. They passed a bill addressing the issue of teachers' health care, but they were unable to give final consideration to the marijuana bill. Under the budget compromise supported by Governor Phil Scott and Democratic leaders, all school districts will be expected to achieve a specific level of savings when they negotiate their health care package with their local teachers' union. And if they don't reach this savings target, then their budget will have to be cut in other places to achieve the savings goal. The governor says it's a fair approach to this issue.
The resolution reached is indeed a compromise, but it's a good one that saves taxpayers millions. We found areas of common ground, and we each gave on areas where there was none. Importantly, the agreement does put into place a mechanism to achieve savings for taxpayers. It aims to keep school employees whole and creates an opportunity to introduce greater equity into the system in the near future.
How will this agreement affect local school boards, and what's the future of the effort to legalize marijuana in Vermont? Today on Vermont Edition, we'll look at these questions with a great panel of reporters. With us today, Elizabeth Hewitt of VT Digger, Alicia Freese of 7 Days, and April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press. Great to have you all back on the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks,
Good
Bob.
To be here.
So let's start with the issue of teachers' health care, and then a little later in the program, we'll discuss the marijuana bill. Elizabeth, the governor, House Speaker Mitzi Johnson, and Senate President Tim Ash have been working on this compromise for about a month. This is the way that Speaker Johnson described the negotiations.
I think compromise is successful when nobody gets everything they want and nobody walks away with their last choice option. So we all walked away feeling good about certain pieces and feeling that other pieces could have been worse.
So, Elizabeth, is this a compromise that we can look at and say, yep, all sides gave a little bit?
Well, we can see that on all sides, certainly, there were some concessions. The plan is very similar to a plan that we saw Senate President Pro Tem and others introduce in the Senate last month, which didn't really go anywhere in the House and sort of was greeted by some skepticism at the time from the administration. And so in that way, there is sort of a concession on the governor's part. On the other hand, I would say that just speaking with lawmakers up at the State House on Wednesday, I heard from Republican legislators, I tended to hear a bit more of a positive reaction to this, that many felt that this was a pretty good deal and the best deal that they could get given the leadership in the House and Senate. And meanwhile, from legislators on the left, there was some grumbling about this and some sort of frustration that they were there at all.
Do you think some of that grumbling took place because school boards are given these specific targets, or what was the grumbling about?
Well, I think for some folks, there was just a general frustration about being there at all. There was frustration about how this process played out. Many people said that they were, you know, they just would have liked to have seen this go through a committee process. This proposal came up fairly late in the legislative session and was pretty much entirely decided behind closed doors and outside of that committee process. And so I think there was some frustration that it wasn't carried out in a more public forum, as tends to be the case in public policy.
And just to review, as these negotiations got underway, the governor said a statewide health care contract for all teachers was the best way to achieve the savings. Democrats insisted on maintaining the local collective bargaining process. Here's how Senator Ash described the final settlement.
We're each able to stand here today feeling like our broad principles have actually been protected, while acknowledging that when you have broad principles and you enter a negotiation, purity will never ultimately prevail.
So, Alicia, the final deal does maintain local collective bargaining, but at the same time, would it be fair to say that it also outlines the parameters of the health care package that teachers would be getting?
It certainly gives strong guidance. I think lawmakers and the governor are definitely making a clear attempt to steer those negotiations to a 80-20 premium split of this particular plan. But school boards do have leeway. There's nothing in the agreement saying it has to come from health insurance savings, which before was, I mean, the governor was saying that it has to come from health savings. So he clearly gave on that during these this last week of negotiations. But for the school boards that have already signed their health insurance contracts, I think people were really surprised to see that those 17 or so districts are going to be included. They're going to be on the hook for these savings as well. And they certainly can't take them from health insurance unless they reopen negotiations, which is probably unlikely.
Well, what happens to those school boards? As you say, 17 or 18 that have got settlements? What are they supposed to do? Are they supposed to go back and reopen everything?
Well, I mean, they would have to get the union, they'd have to get the teachers to agree to reopen negotiations, and I don't see the teachers doing that. So that leaves them trying to scrounge up savings or making cuts in, elsewhere. You know, it could be programs, anywhere they can find savings.
In April, on this very subject, many school board members have expressed concern because if they don't meet the target for the health care savings, they're going to have to cut their budget in some other areas, as Alicia was just saying. And yesterday at his weekly press conference, the governor acknowledged this situation could be difficult for some school boards.
It's not an ideal situation, and I do understand the fear of many and the school boards that work so hard and on behalf of the taxpayers to keep their budgets in line, and this does could possibly put more burden on them.
April, are we hearing from the school boards that this has put them in a very untenable situation?
Yes, and this proposal in some ways started as an idea of the School Boards Association and the Superintendents Association. It morphed and it kind of turned into something that they ended up not being happy with. So that it's just interesting to think back from February and March when this was first getting started, and it was an idea brought forward by these school organizations. But yes, they are in a difficult position. The governor pointed out that the total amount of savings, which is $13 million, is split over 2 years, which is an attempt to try to mitigate some of the pain that comes from those potential cuts that would need to be made to programs or whatever. The first year is 65%, and then the second year is 35%. So there's a little bit of a cushion. But it's still, we're going to have to see how this plays out. You know, it's possible that school districts who've already settled their contracts found some savings in healthcare already. So maybe they already have some of that money somehow in their budget. But for a lot of places, it's going to be a difficult conversation. And the new fiscal year for them starts next week.
In April, what happens to the roughly two dozen school districts where an impasse has been declared? Do they now go back and reopen those contracts?
Yes, and that was a new piece. Well, they could. That was a new piece that was part of this compromise deal. There's a provision in there that says if healthcare was the sticking point that led them to an impasse, that these school districts and teachers who are at impasse can go back to that piece and reopen those negotiations. And so I don't know if we'll see that making, I'm not sure what we'll see from that, if we'll actually see a lot of them go back and renegotiate there.
Elizabeth, as you mentioned, this bill, there wasn't a lot of discussion of it out in the open in the last month or so. Legislative leaders were criticized for conducting much of their negotiations in private. I don't think most members of the legislature or members of the public had any idea of what was being discussed. And Speaker Johnson defended this approach.
I think you will find that what's here is not some newly conjured up beast that nobody's ever seen before. It's components of things that people have weighed in on, that legislators have seen before.
So do you think there was a lot of grumbling from lawmakers about, hey, you had a month to work on this, and then all of a sudden you come back and bingo, here it is, take it or leave it?
You know, I think that was a factor for many. As I mentioned before, there, particularly from House Democrats, I heard frustration that this hadn't gone through that committee process. One thing that I would just add as background for this is that it in a sense, is not that atypical to have discussions at the end of a legislative session happening behind closed doors. It's sort of an annual routine in Montpelier, as as the deals are getting closer and closer on the budget, that the final decisions tend to be made, you know, in somebody's office as opposed to in a committee room. And then everybody comes together around that idea. And so this, in some senses, was just a broader, like it was an extended version of that. It just happened to stretch out over, in this case, months. That sort of secrecy is not totally new. I think that there's a lot of uneasiness among some legislators around this because they haven't had a chance to take this back to their communities. This proposal just came out very late on Tuesday night. They voted on it less than 24 hours later. They didn't really have a chance to go back and check in with their folks at home and bring that to inform their decisions in Montpelier. And so I think that did sort of add to that sense of grumbling around it.
Let's go to our listeners and start off with Andy, who's calling from Brattleboro. Hey, Andy, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you. I'll get right to my point. I'm a teacher of 30-plus years here in Brattleboro Public Schools. This whole thing was presented to us that we had to redo all of the insurance because the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, was going to place a tax on the so-called Cadillac plans that many teachers were in that category. And now that the Republicans are on the verge of getting rid of that tax, I'm wondering, you know, why this whole thing just seems like Alice in Wonderland to me. The other part of my question, and then I'll comment, and then I'll get off the air, and you guys can toss it about is, you know, healthcare is part of a compensation package. And I think that if you want to get the teachers involved in this healthcare reform, you got to go back to single payer. Because otherwise, you're really talking about our hard-fought compensation packages. And that's going to be a stumbling block until we move along to single payer. Thank you for taking on this topic. I'll just listen on the air. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much, Andy. Alicia, it is kind of an interesting situation that this was all put in place because of the Affordable Care Act, and we're going to have a vote in the Senate next week on it. Who knows what the final outcome would be, but it is interesting that that's taking place.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a kind of quirk of timing, I think. I mean, the caller is right. We don't know if, as you said, we don't know what the fate of this healthcare bill at the national level will be. So the legislature kind of has to assume that the status quo is going to continue onwards, and then also the fiscal year is about to start. So I think it's too late at this point to reel this whole renegotiation process back in.
And let's turn to Patrick in Westford. Hey, Patrick, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Actually, kind of following on with the previous caller, it seems like this property tax issue would sort of form the core of a conservative argument for single payer. I'm curious if any Republican lawmakers have spoken out about that. Seems like, especially with Republican governors in Montpelier, that's not very likely for the time being. But and correct me if I'm wrong, Act 48, I believe, is still on the books. So it seems like the framework's there. If legislators really, you know, especially depending on what happens and what comes out of in terms of Trump care, it seems like we may have that back on the plate sooner than any of us.
Okay, Patrick, we had a little trouble hearing you, but the whole idea of could this revive single payer? April, what do you think? Do you think lawmakers will have the appetite to look at single payer next year?
You know, I've heard very few mentions of single payer at the State House this session. I have heard some enthusiasm for it from the Vermont NEA, from the President Martha Allen, who pointed out, as the previous caller said, that in her view that this will not be resolved until there's a single payer system. But I have not heard a broad call for reviving the single payer debate at this point.
The budget passed the House originally on a vote of 143-1, Elizabeth, and over the Senate it was 30-0. And yet when the final votes were taken on the budget compromise on Wednesday, we didn't have a recorded roll call vote in the Senate or in the House. It was a voice vote in both cases, which I thought was a little unusual. Were people not willing to go on the record about how they voted? What did you think? What did you make of that whole situation?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that actually over the last couple of days, because it is unusual. Typically, when the those big finance bills come through at the end, you'll see somebody will call for a roll call just so that they can get folks on the record as to how they supported it. And in this case, the whole action on both chambers happened within just a couple hours, and they never went through that roll call process on the full bill. And I kind of took that as a combination of a desire to sort of get moving and get out of there. By that time, it was dinner time, and everybody wanted to get going. And also, I took it as sort of a reflection of that this was a compromise that nobody fully endorsed, you know, that it was nobody's first choice, and so perhaps there was just less willingness to go through that process.
We got a couple of emails on this issue. We got this from Paul in Hinesburg. The compromise on teachers' health insurance presents excellent evidence that local control is dead. This stopgap solution did nothing to reduce the countless hours and dollars that will be spent during contract negotiations and will have no positive impact on students in the classroom. All sides need to acknowledge the statewide nature of our education funding system and behave accordingly. We got this from Kathy in Montpelier. So the legislature and governor solved their budget impasse by kicking the problem down to school boards. That is lack of leadership and bad governing. We should all remember this next time we vote. I guess it was a compromise, Alicia, that when we heard folks talking about it, both Senator Ash, Speaker Johnson, and even the governor, there was a certain lack of enthusiasm for this deal.
Certainly. I would not characterize the mood in the Cedar Creek room at their press conferences jubilant by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, they were trotting out the same lines about, isn't this great that we've come to a compromise? I do think that the governor can now, you know, he'll have this line, I forced the legislature to save $13 million over 2 years, and he can kind of extract that from this whole complicated debate and hold that up. That said, the actual proposal that they landed on is quite different than what he initially proposed. It is interesting, though, and we haven't talked about one other part of that proposal, which is a commission, which we all kind of laugh at this point. Commissions don't have a great track record of resulting in action. But in this case, they've actually put together a fairly serious commission to look at the potential of a statewide contract for teachers' health insurance. And they've required all the contracts to expire in 2019, so providing another opportunity at this statewide contract. So I think that could quite likely come to fruition.
I'm glad you mentioned that, and the whole work of the commission and its report that will be coming out, and lawmakers will be able to look at those recommendations during the 2018 session. April, some people are wondering, why did the Democratic leaders ever agree to this deal? The teachers' union doesn't like it. The school boards association doesn't like it. Why didn't the Democrats just say, you know, we don't like it either? Were they afraid that they might lose a public relations battle with the governor over this issue?
That's a complicated question. I think in terms of the public relations piece, I do think that the governor had very strong messaging. Alicia kind of alluded to that, that when you can say you're saving money, you're lowering property taxes, that's a very strong message. It's very potent. And some of the arguments that were being raised by the Democrats were more about process and more about legal considerations, which are a lot harder to communicate. So there is that. I also think that the Democrats also do want to save money, that they also are concerned about property taxes. And so that played in as well. And then also just they needed to work something out with the veto. So they were kind of forced to give some ground here that they didn't want to give.
And Elizabeth, if the school boards are able to hold the line on health care spending, in some districts, the teachers might say, well, we'd like an increase in wages. So can one kind of offset the other?
I don't know too much about that. I mean, I think we're going to see a lot about how this deal plays out over the next. It's now going to be playing out at the local level, and we're going to be seeing this, how it actually shakes out. And it seems like there is definitely some wiggle room for how this could turn out differently in different districts. Just sort of piggybacking on what Alicia and April have been talking about, I think that how that plays out on a local level too is going to be one of the political factors in how this deal manifests down the road. You know, there's an election that's going to be coming next year. And I think at this point, the governor has been able, all parties have been able to say that they, you know, in some respect have saved face here. But I think the real implications for each party politically are going to be realized after we see how this shakes out on the local level and how many schools are needing to make programmatic cuts or something that impacts their districts. That could be a factor next November.
Alicia, do you think this agreement in the veto session basically settles this issue politically, as Elizabeth was talking about? Or are these going to be hot issues in next year's legislative session and potentially the elections?
I think it's the latter. I think this will very much feature into next session. I think there's certainly going to be a debate specifically about that issue of a statewide contract. I think that was a something that both the Vermont NEA and the School Boards Association brought up. They didn't seem to have much appetite to revisit this at this point, but they said, you know, we're going to be having the exact same debate next year.
Today we're looking at the issues of the veto session with a great group of reporters: Alicia Fries of 7 Days, April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press, and Elizabeth Hewitt of VT Digger. During the session, Democratic leaders and the governor were able to reach a final agreement on a new marijuana legalization bill. It allows people over 21 to possess up to an ounce of marijuana, and they can grow several plants. The bill also created a commission to study a variety of issues, including driver impairment and the implementation of a full state regulatory system with retail stores and the taxation of marijuana. Senate Judiciary Chairman Dick Sears said the plan was a good step forward.
It does at least put us in a position to pass marijuana legalization this year, get the commission working on a regulated system so that we can at least be somewhat in a time frame with Massachusetts when they go online with their legalization.
Elizabeth, you've been following this issue closely. Were you surprised that they reached an agreement and then the Senate passed the bill with no debate?
I was not surprised by that. I think the governor was very specific in his critiques of the bill when he sent a message back to the legislature, and lawmakers were very willing to work with him on that, and they did for weeks. And so it wasn't too surprising to me that they reached that agreement. His points included creating stricter penalties for using marijuana in a car with kids, for dispensing marijuana to those who are underage, and some other factors like that were really around his key issues of road safety and access and exposure of children to marijuana. So it didn't surprise me that it passed there, that it got his approval. It also didn't surprise me that it passed the Senate. The Senate has passed marijuana legalization 5 times now in the last 2 years. So this is becoming, it's an issue that in that chamber is very popular, and there's a clear momentum forward. There is not such momentum in the House, which of course is where this bill ended up failing during this veto session. It didn't even come up for a vote because there was not enough support to suspend the parliamentary rules that would allow the chamber to expedite action on a bill instead of waiting the time frames that are required under law. So that also I think was not surprising. I think many people sort of expected that to be how it played out, although there was certainly some hope from those in favor that particularly House Republicans would come around to support at least a suspension of the rules because the governor had come to an agreement on and said he would back this deal.
As Elizabeth mentioned, the legislation did go to the House for its consideration. They needed a rule suspension there to bring it to the floor. House Judiciary Chairwoman Maxine Grad urged House Republicans not to block the bill because she thinks many Vermonters are eager to have a vote on this issue.
Vermonters should have the opportunity to be involved in the conversation, and by having the vote come to the floor, it allows us as representatives to have the conversation.
But House Minority Leader Don Turner said his caucus would not suspend rules because Turner didn't want Vermont rushing into this decision.
We will learn from each of those places that legalize it in whatever way, shape, or form they legalize it, and the issues that crop up as a result of the way they've legalized it, we won't have to go down that path. So I don't know why we don't need to be first. We don't even need to be 25th in my mind. Let's learn from the people that have legalized it.
Alicia, we should say that the people who decided not to suspend rules, most of the Republicans in the House, they were also joined by a handful of Democrats and independents. I think we thought going into this, this could actually be a pretty close vote for a rule suspension. But Alicia, they fell 29 votes short. Was that somewhat of a surprise?
You know, with this particular legislation, I'm beyond the point of surprise. I mean, this bill, or some variation of it, died and was reborn I don't know how many times. I mean, even in the final hours, we were going back and forth, and yes, that there was going to be a rule suspension. No, there wasn't. I really have lost the ability to be surprised. I mean, I do think, you know, what Turner was saying about rushing into it, I think that argument has lost some of its sway. The particular legislation that the House was voting on yesterday wouldn't have legalized until July 2018. So you had a year anyway. I think this was a matter of, you know, primarily Republicans saying, we know this is going to happen, but let's just push it back as far as we can.
Let's go to our callers and talk to Gail in Elizabethtown. Hi, Gail. Welcome to the program.
I wanted to congratulate the legislature for coming up with the no-cash bill that runs right around the ends over the feds, saying that they aren't going to let us bank and all that stuff. And also, you're legalizing what people have been doing all along. But over here in New York, the New York State Legislature passed out hemp seeds years ago so that we'd have plenty of rope. So I think it's a good plant, and we should keep it around. And if people get well, that's their right.
All right, Gail, thanks very much for your phone call. Let's turn to Mike in South Stratford. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hey, thanks. I just wanted to comment on how disappointing it is that that some kind of legalization bill can't be passed. There's several good reasons for it. First, there are people being hurt right now because it is illegal. There are people getting charged with felonies. There's a certain amount of selective enforcement by the police. I personally know someone who is in a lot of pain, who is being prescribed things like fentanyl. And he had an out-of-state card for medical marijuana, but there's a waiting period here. Long story short, he ends up charged with a couple of felonies, and so people are being hurt, and it's going to be legal around us, particularly down south, and so all of the tax revenue is going to be flowing out of the state because people are going to drive to get it. It's disappointing, and I don't understand the reasons against it. We don't want to be first. That's not really a reason. The highway safety thing, that's not really a reason because, you know, whoever uses marijuana is driving stone now. And the Colorado experiment did not show evidence of that increasing. So there really isn't a valid argument against it. It's very disappointing.
Mike, I have a question for you. The House was supporting this personal possession approach where the Senate was going for the full state regulatory model, much like Colorado. Which one do you favor?
I think both. I think you can have a homegrown component because I think there's a lot of farmers in Vermont. There's a lot of land, and I think you can go with the sales. I don't see any reason why you can't have both.
All right, Mike, thanks very much for your phone call. You know, at his press conference at the end of last month, Governor Scott said he would talk to the House GOP caucus about this issue of suspending rules, and he said he would, quote, advocate for it. But yesterday at his press conference, the governor said that while he spoke to the caucus, he didn't ask them to suspend rules or vote for the bill.
I didn't encourage them. I didn't twist any arms. This is a personal decision that they had to make. They decided at that point they were going to come together and decide as a caucus.
So, April, the governor always said that this was not a top priority for him. Any kind of surprise that he really didn't work to get it passed at all?
I guess I was surprised that he was so hands-off. I didn't expect him to be jumping up and down trying to get it passed, but just that he didn't really seem to... He said he didn't put really any personal effort into convincing Republicans to suspend the rules, even though he was part of this deal that led to it coming up in the first place. So I think it was kind of a way for him to... He still has significant constituency, I think, that as opposed to marijuana legalization, not just Republicans, but also Democrats. And I think he's kind of trying to play it both ways so that he can kind of allow a way for it to go forward, but also not look like he's pushing for it.
Right. You can't pin the failure on him mm-hmm. now. You can pin it on House Republicans most directly.
Right.
He can make some kind of plausible case that he tried, but he also got his way and that it didn't happen.
Right. And then he can also he announced at the press conference this week that now that the marijuana bill did not go through, he's going to form his own commission to study issues of highway safety and public health, things that he was always concerned about in the first place. And he can have that commission on his own terms now while the bill is still stalled.
Today we're looking at the issues of a veto session with a panel of reporters: April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press, Elizabeth Hewitt of VT Digger, and Alicia Friese of 7 Days. We're discussing the marijuana bill. It passed the Senate on Wednesday, but they could not get a rule suspension in the House, and so it did not come up for consideration on the floor. Elizabeth, some supporters of the bill, I'm thinking now of Caledonia Senator Joe Benning, is pretty optimistic about the future of this bill, disappointed that it didn't pass in the veto session. But he thinks they'll be successful when they come back in January and that it'll take a week or two to get the bill passed. How do things look for passage of this bill in 2018?
Well, it will be interesting to see how that plays out. When lawmakers come back, there are actually a number of different bills that are in various stages of the legislative process that have to do with marijuana legalization. And so I think there's some optimism among some who are really supportive of this model of, it's like the Washington, D.C. model of possession, but there's no regulated structure, who would like to see this go forward, and especially since the governor has already suggested his support for it. On the other hand, I think we're also, now that we have stretched it, extended this into the second half of the session, there's more room for discussion and debate, and I think that we will see a renewed push from those who prefer that Colorado-style model of regulation, that includes most of the people in the Senate who really feel that that's the best way to go forward. Especially, we heard from Senator Sears, he often brings up that very soon there's going to be a regulated market sort of right out his back door there in Bennington County in Massachusetts. And so I think in a way, it'll be interesting to see if that deal that was brokered over the last couple of weeks is taken up when they come back in January, or if this starts to take on a different shape entirely, which it well could.
And Alicia, we were discussing the commission that was included in the bill, but now the governor says he may create that, probably will create that, with an executive order, and that he now gets to determine kind of the agenda of that commission. This commission could play an important role when lawmakers come back next January to reconsider this issue?
Yeah, I think so. The commission that lawmakers wanted would have really set up the framework for regulation. And, you know, I don't know if how interested Scott's going to be in setting up a commission to do that. That may be, I would be surprised if that was their main assignment. I think he will focus on safety issues, and you know, that puts the state further behind in terms of establishing a regulation system.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Cindy in Dover. Hi, Cindy. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Great. What's on your mind today?
What's on my mind is, as a local tavern owner, the way the laws state about people's consumption, we have the availability to be able to shut people off if they've come in, they've had too much to drink, or they're under the influence. And what's going to happen with the legalization of marijuana, the way the liabilities laws read now is that we're responsible for people when they walk in the door about being intoxicated. And so what are the laws going to be about shutting people off that we perceive that have come in stoned? Is the Liquor Control Board of the state of Vermont then going to proceed with training for us to be able to evaluate those people and be able to come in and say, we can't serve you because you're under the influence of marijuana, you're high, we can't have you here, all of those things. There's a huge other liability problem that nobody, from what I have seen, heard, or discussed, has even touched on yet. What is going to be the bar owner's responsibility or the people that work there when somebody comes in stoned and having them leave?
Cindy, what do you do now? What happens now when someone comes in and you think they're under the influence of some drug, be it legal or illegal, but you have the definite impression that they are being affected by the drug? What do you do in those cases now?
We can tell them that we can't serve them, and because the way the Vermont state laws are and the liability laws, they don't have a leg to stand on. We don't have to serve you. You're under the influence of something. And if somebody comes in that is now what we perceive to be stoned or high, and there's no law stating that we don't have to serve that person. Right now we can say, you know what, sorry guys, have a glass of water, sober up, sit in the parking lot, wait until you can leave. But right now, if somebody comes in stoned, what is our recourse going to be? Is there any legislation about over-serving people that are stoned, or they come in stoned and they pass out at the bar because they fall asleep?
Cindy, thanks very much for your phone call. Elizabeth, have you heard this discussed as you followed this bill?
There has been some discussion of liability around if, I believe, if like a young person, somebody underage, gets access to marijuana, which I believe is similar to current laws that have to do with folks who are underage accessing alcohol. But I have not heard anything along what Cindy brought up, and I think that's a really interesting point, and sort of reinforces the, you know, this is a very big topic for many, and so there are lots of details that likely would be worked out, still need to be discussed, and will likely be sort of uncovered as this process moves on.
We've gotten a couple of emails about the teachers' health care situation and a couple of questions. Scott in Montpelier would like to know, what happens if a school district doesn't hit their savings target? Are they forced to? Alicia, what happens?
Yes, the answer is yes. So the state is, the way that they're enforcing this is that they are going to withhold funds from the education fund that would normally go out to the district. So they do have a mechanism to make sure that schools find those savings.
And what part of the concern is that schools might end up deficit spending if they can't find the savings, which then puts them in a difficult position for the following year. And there is some concern about what that's going to do to the tax rate or education budgets next year.
And April, some people are concerned that there's some one-time money being used to lower property tax rates.
Yeah, there's about $35 million that's being used in the way that they set up the tax situation from the education fund. And the governor seems to think, we asked him about it yesterday, and he seems to think that that it'll all work out okay, that there might be some other money that comes out of the system that we'll be able to, it won't be a huge jump next year, but that remains to be seen.
We also got this email from Roberta, who asks, with the legislature easily passing the budget, and it was a very strong vote, could they have voted to override the veto? I never heard any mention of an override. Elizabeth, it fell pretty much along party lines at that point, didn't it?
They did. There were override votes on both the budget and the yield bills, and both failed. And it was pretty much straight along party lines with some variation there.
April, looking ahead to January of 2018, do you think it's a slam dunk that lawmakers are going to give their approval to the marijuana bill, or could things pop up between now and then to make it less likely to happen?
I think it's, in my view, it's likely that something will go through next year. But as we've seen throughout this whole process, there are so many different questions that come up along the way, so many different philosophies that clash. It's not simple as legalize or don't legalize. It's how you legalize. And we have all this time now between now and January where some of those different factions could continue debating, and we don't really know what's going to come out at the end of it. So I think even people who oppose a lot of the people who oppose the legalization bill acknowledge that it will be legalized some point. It's just a matter of when. And so I think now that all the perspectives have been aired, I think we're poised for some type of legalization. I just don't know when or how.
Yeah, I do think they lose a little ground. I mean, I think part of the reason proponents were able to stitch together this coalition was that there was this sense of urgency. You know, the session is ending and this is our chance. And now that they've got some more time, I think it could be more challenging to hold together some type of coalition.
You know, Elizabeth, we look at the states that have legalized marijuana. They've all been done by voter referendum. No state has legalized marijuana through the legislative process. Are we finding out now why it is so difficult to do it that way?
I think we might be. You know, there's so many different ways to do this. It's really, we've seen some models in different states, but here we have a chance for lawmakers to craft a bill. And there's a lot of ways that can splinter. And so I guess we will just have to wait and see what they work up next year. But it certainly there is definitely not a prescribed path at this point, I would say.
And it's interesting, in Massachusetts, where it was adopted in a voter referendum, and the referendum was pretty specific. We actually see lawmakers in Massachusetts this week debating what the bill should do, kind of going back on some of the promises and pledges that were made in the voter referendum.
That's right. We did. And actually, just as one little addendum here, I did hear from Senator Sears, who's been a champion of this bill, that he actually said maybe it's time to put this to a non-binding voter referendum here in Vermont to see how voters feel about it. And so we'll see if there's a push to do it in that way. But there are definitely a lot of different directions that this issue could go from here. But I think it's safe to say that it's not over.
Let's look at the people and issues of the veto session. Many thanks to our panel today, Alicia Freese of 7 Days, April McCollum of the Burlington Free Press, and Elizabeth Hewitt of VT Digger. Thank you all very, very much.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having
us. Thank you.